So welcome to the 9th edition of the Media Schwitz. I'm Mark Glazer, executive editor of PBS Media Shift, along with Rafat Ali, founder of Paid Content, and soon to go on the last kind of postscript trip of his sabbatical. Where are you heading?
Hey, Mark. I mean, it certainly was not planned, but I feel like I can tuck in one more trip before I seriously start on my next company. And I'm going to Uzbekistan for about 10 days. And
wow.
It's the start of summer there, so it's going to be plenty hot, about 90 degrees and above. But I don't think New York is going to be that much different, so might as well.
So you think this is the kind of trip where you're going to be connected to things, or do you think it's the kind of trip where you're just going to be totally unplugged and just checking things out?
No, I think Uzbekistan has a pretty vibrant mobile network economy, so to speak. So I'm guessing I'm going to get a local SIM. I used Google Android phones, so which are open phones, and I'm just going to buy a local SIM and buy a data package, and it's a large country. I mean, it's like 24 million people, so it's not a small country, and they have a lot of mobile phone penetration. So yeah, I should be connected.
Maybe not enough to continue to do the podcast, though.
No, I think I'll be off for 2 weeks, so I'm sure we'll be able to find some alternatives.
Yeah, well, that sounds good. And it sounds like you're having a little issues with your some technical troubles with your mouse too, huh?
I am, yeah. This the whole morning was spending that, and it took me 3 hours to book the flight from here to Tashkent, which is the capital of Uzbekistan.
Well, hopefully you'll keep everyone posted, at least through maybe some Facebook updates or Twitter, just so we know what's going on and we can see some pictures of what it's like there.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll do that.
And you can tell us all about the media situation there too. I'm sure this will be a fact-finding trip.
Yes, that's my main goal, is to go for a media fact.
We know that. So on today's show, we're going to talk about, it's not a really heavy news week. We don't have any big, huge buyouts or anything happening, but we thought it was interesting to talk about or look at. Twitter has bought out TweetDeck. An application, kind of a desktop mobile application for power users of Twitter, and what that means for users of Twitter, and also what that means for the platform, the Twitter platform, and how people kind of build applications on top of it, and then maybe they change the rules about it. Then we'll have a special guest, Jen Lee Reeves from the University of Missouri and KOMU-TV in Columbia, Missouri, and she's been tracking the tornadoes that happened in Joplin, Missouri, and some severe storms and severe weather that's been going on there for the last week, and how they've used the Facebook page of KOMU to really connect with the community and keep people informed. And finally, we're going to talk about conflicts of interest for technology bloggers, and kind of a tempest in a teapot that's happened with Michael Arrington of TechCrunch and Kara Swisher at All Things D, and maybe even Om Malik at GigaOm, and just what the conflicts are when journalists are investing in companies that they cover and how they deal with that. So first we'll talk about Twitter buying TweetDeck. Twitter has been valued at multiple billions of dollars and has had some major rounds of funding. So they have a lot of money to play with. They've bought up Tweety. They bought up some other apps that have been built on their platform. This one is supposedly a $50 million buyout. TweetDeck, I believe, only has about 15 people on their team and has in the millions of users. But I guess the question is, you know, why do they need to buy out TweetDeck? What are they going to do with it? There's talk that they will use it as kind of a way to get kind of catered to the influential crowd within Twitter. And Twitter itself even feels like it's kind of a really kind of an influencer network. So this is kind of the influencers of the influencers. Right.
So yeah, I think it's interesting. There's a bunch of stories behind what happened with the Twitter buying TweetDeck and how it came about. As you probably know, another rival, Uber Media, which owns a bunch of Twitter clients, was close to buying TweetDeck when the news leaked and then Twitter came in. And just it's more of a people saying it's more of a defensive buy. But really, I think TweetDeck, as you know, is the largest, probably the first and the largest desktop client for Twitter. So I think it gives them a very captive audience from that perspective. I think one of the things that Twitter has been lacking, and there have been a bunch of stories, including that big story in Fortune magazine that you probably read about a month ago.
Right, about this is about their kind of corporate issues
With the leadership and stuff, and how that's led to stagnation in product development. And everybody seems to sort of agree on at least the fact that their product development hasn't been great for the last year or so. So I think this at least gives them some kickstart in that. What it's not organic, but they sort of bought it, and the team behind TweetDeck is a very stellar team.
Right, but I guess, and so maybe the bigger question is: okay, they buy out TweetDeck. They have, you know, certain apps that are now Twitter owned, and then they're going up against, let's say, apps that are owned by Uber Media and other people. Does that take what was an open platform and kind of could that possibly change the rules for different people? Like some people that are in the Twitter, you know, owned by Twitter might have some kind of advantage?
Yeah, I mean, so this is, as you know well, this is not a new phenomenon for Twitter. They've been clamping down on their ecosystem for the last, really the year since Dick Costello came in as the COO initially and then CEO, and now back to, I think, being the CEO. I don't know. I can't even keep track of all their changes.
I think he's still CEO.
He's still CEO. Okay. As of today. and so I think they've been clamping down. They've clamped down a bunch on the photo sites that were like TweetPic and others, because they just wanted to build their own, and then some of the clients and stuff they bought, they certainly bought the iPhone client, and then branded it their own, and they've publicly said that they want to keep that in check, because I guess they realize that they want to make money off this. To think that Twitter is an open network is probably delusional to some extent at this point.
Does the same go for Facebook and Apple and other people who've kind of said, hey, develop on our platform, this is all open, here's the API, go ahead and work on it. You know, somewhere there's probably some kind of clause in there, you know, we have the right to change, you know, the terms of this kind of deal.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
somewhere
Apple
down the line.
Apple, you know, I mean, we don't even have to repeat the Apple's closed ecosystem, Facebook also as well. So will it inhibit innovation in Twitter? I mean, what do you think?
Yeah, I guess that's hard to say, because I guess if you think that, well, maybe your end game as a startup is to be bought by Twitter, maybe that's not such a bad thing. But yeah, I think that it could hurt innovation if you're going to start up and you just think, well, if I'm not going to get bought by Twitter, they can't buy everything. What kind of rules am I going to be playing by, and how can I deal with that? The other question about Twitter I have is just, you know, and that's been brought up before. I know the Wall Street Journal had a big article about, you know, not only is it the turmoil with leadership, but also just how to get and retain kind of a mainstream audience. There was a big interest, you know, when there was Oprah and Ashton Kutcher and everything a few years ago. But, you know, I tend to find a lot of my friends that aren't necessarily, you know, so tech, you know, overloaded. They just feel like, why bother? You know, hard to get that case for someone, you know, like in a generation that's older, or just it's really hard to get people to, they don't get it as quickly as they would Facebook.
Yeah, I think so. And it seems that I think they probably run out of some ideas on how to increase their audience dramatically beyond what they have right now. I mean, we don't see a lot of good ideas coming out from there in terms of how do you do that, besides working with some of the brands like MTV and some of the media brands and hoping that people see it and adopt it and stuff. So I think that's a good question. One of the other things that I realized over the last few days. So TechCrunch Disrupt conference was happening over the last few days. I think it's finishing today or finished yesterday.
Right.
There are all these startups that presented. Guess what kind of startups weren't there? There are no Twitter-based or Facebook-based startups anymore. I mean, there were a lot last year, the year before, but very few of them purely based on Twitter and Facebook. And even if they had Twitter and Facebook plugins, the judges, one of the first questions that judges were asking was, what if Twitter turns you off? And do you have a backup? So one of these companies called Sonar.me, which I think was one of the runner-ups, one of the first questions in the final round was that.
So Jen Reeves worked in television news for the majority of her career. The last 6 years, she's moved from traditional journalist to non-traditional thinker about journalism and education. She's currently new media director at KOMU-TV and KOMU.com. And at the same time, she's an associate professor at the Missouri School of Journalism and was part of the inaugural class of Reynolds Journalism Institute Fellows. She contributes to PBS Media Shift on journalism education issues, and lately she's been at the center of what's been going on with the tornadoes in Joplin, Missouri, and just a lot of severe weather and severe storms in mid-Missouri. Welcome to the show, Jen.
How you guys doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm
good.
Exhausted.
I wonder how that could happen.
I know, right?
So I guess first tell us just what's the situation there right now, storm-wise? Have things cleared up at all, or are there still threats? What's happening right now?
Well, luckily, the majority of the threats have left our region. Thank goodness. We know that because the temperatures have dropped, and that's always a good sign for us. But we had an incredibly long stretch of days where the majority of our state was put at risk. And yesterday was just another day of rolling tornadoes, very scary. We had another area in my part of Missouri, our market, that had some substantial damage. Fortunately, no one was killed. We have about 20 injuries, and we're just swamped with unbelievable stories and rescue attempts, relief efforts. Our newsroom's currently having a telethon tonight. Just all kinds of things. Our community, although not as badly affected, it feels just as closely affected to Joplin. So many people have connections and are trying to reach out and help in any way possible.
I can imagine. And you wrote a story for Media Shift about just the role that Facebook has played in this. Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, how you used Facebook, and also if it was any different than in previous stories or previous breaking news that you guys covered?
Yeah, sure. My market is a very heavy, heavy Facebook area. And because of that, I went to that space to coordinate a lot of conversations, because I know that, from so many social interactions with our market, that is where we needed to talk the most. So what we were finding is that Twitter was the space where we were getting a lot of, this is happening now. But what our markets wanted to talk about, how can we help and what do we need to know on Facebook. And I've learned that because I'm there a lot. I'm in charge of interactive for our newsroom. And being in charge of interactive for a newsroom, to me, is I'm in charge of helping coordinate conversations in our community. And I know that our market believes that we are a part of that. And I think we learned a lot when we had severe snow shut down our state in February. I think that taught a lot of people in our market that they knew they could come to me and my newsroom on Facebook. And I think that's why it's become a hub, not the only hub, but a regional hub to talk about how to help Joplin and what's going on with severe weather in our area as well.
So, Jen, this is Rafat. Hi there. The question I have is, so you're saying Facebook, and usually when media talks about sort of breaking events, especially weather or any kind of calamity, they usually talk about Twitter. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that for, in your case, that wasn't that much of that wasn't that big an outlet.
Let me maybe clarify. Our newsroom has a very coordinated effort in Twitter. I have a lot of people that manage Twitter. In my newsroom, we use a tool called CoTweet. And so as the interactive manager in my newsroom, I knew I had a lot of people that could keep track of the conversations there. So we were able to keep up with the things people were sharing. But the calls for can we help and where can we go and those kinds of conversations, that was on Facebook. That came on Facebook. The this is what's happening now was on Twitter. The how can we help, what can we do was on Facebook.
So there's almost more interaction going on in Facebook in a way.
In this market, yeah. I mean, if you go to Seattle, I bet they'll say, nope, that's Twitter. It just depends on where you're at. And I think because I've had so much time here and I've kind of been here from the bottom up of social media, I know that my market is, you know, the conversations like this, the how can we help rebuilding discussion is going to be in Facebook. And when people were freaking out and for good reason more severe weather, they came to our Facebook. They came to our weather page on our website. You know, it was kind of a combination. People were on our interactive radar on one page and talking to us on Facebook and the other.
Do you feel there was the story that media shifted and there was a wish list of, I think, features that you would have liked to have on Facebook beyond? Well, first, if you want to talk a little bit about that. And then secondly, do you feel that whatever you put on Facebook is still temporary and it will sort of disappear in ether? I mean, Twitter, we know it will. But even on Facebook?
This has been a really interesting experience because Facebook, most of the time, there does seem to be a sustainable life for content. But when you have so many people wanting to ask a question or contribute or ask, you know, a call to action, I've found that it is moving almost as rapid as Twitter. I'm helping moderate it's a major Joplin relief page. The last time I checked, it had 160-something thousand people participating in that page. It rolls like Twitter. The moderators and I we have messages that we're trying to post every 10 minutes with information to help answer the questions that people have. On my newsroom site, it isn't rolling as fast unless we had severe weather rolling through. It was the same Twitter speed. I found that when people were asking the same question again and again and again, I just couldn't keep the message high enough for people to read it. Even if it's in and this is another thing, information for pages often are read on your news feed on Facebook. And I think people are actually coming to my page right now to get the information instead of just assuming we'll show up in the news feed, which I think is an interesting shift during this time. And because they are coming to my page, I was running some information in a discussion page that's on Facebook. My page is a TV station category because that's where I work. And apparently TV stations don't get notes automatically. Fortunately, thanks to the piece I wrote for Media Shift, I learned how to add notes thanks to my wish list. So we've added notes. That is permanent, but I have to continuously send people to it. It would be so nice to be able to at least say, hey, we have a list of all the different relief efforts going on right now. Just go to the notes page, or here's a link, or something. One little box would go so far to help answer questions in this kind of situation. That would be wonderful.
But then you have to get into kind of doing more kind of custom design for your Facebook page, which probably has some costs associated with it.
Right. And then, you know, I'm a small market. I don't spend money on this stuff. I just work really hard. That's it. so we we could have built some kind of custom iframe thing, but people coming to the wall, and I'm talking about the wall. There's all kinds of links and iframes and things we could do, but what I'm dealing with is the community that is on our wall, and it would be wonderful to have a little alert box. Groups have this. The Facebook groups, when you visit a group, there's an explanation of what that group is, if you're not the manager of it. And simple little, just one little box could go a long way. And another interesting thing that I've done, and I learned from KMOV when they had tornadoes roll through, you can leave your signature of either your Facebook, your personal Facebook page or your profile. So you can basically have a signature on a post, even if you're representing the brand.
Do you think, the TV news stations, especially the local stations, have their websites for a long time have sucked, and this is not this my is so subjective true. This is not my subjective opinion. This is probably true.
I'm totally with you.
A lot of people, and a lot of it has to do with the sort of affiliates using cookie cutter CMS systems and stuff that they've been locked into for multi-year contracts and all the stuff that you know.
Yeah.
Do you think that sort of Facebook and Twitter then gives you just gives you a lot more freedom, at least in terms of the putting your stuff out there as opposed to the website, which you can only do so much?
Right. Well, I'm very fortunate. In the last 6 months, I went from a TV website that was poo to a TV website that is new. I've been able to work with it a lot better than anything I've had before. We're working off of a concept that is continuous news, a river of news. Anytime we have a new update, we're posting it as a new item on our site. And then linking to all former links, little links to the history of what we're talking about. And I've found that with that process, having new updates on our site, linking, we're bringing the links to our Facebook page. We're having more interaction or at least traffic to our site than we've ever had before. And more people reading more of our items online than ever before with what's happening. The conversations are still are happening where people are already at, and I'm not going to require them to have the conversation on my website. So I'm just, kind of building a bridge between the two, and they really are coming. When I share information on our website, they're coming to it. If there's an update, I'll tell them on Facebook and they'll go to it.
Thanks for joining us. Thanks for the great story, and keep us posted on how things are going. Hopefully the weather will improve.
I have hope for that. And if I learn more lessons, I'll certainly share.
The last thing we're going to talk about is conflicts of interest for tech bloggers and tech journalists. This is also kind of an old story, but just kind of keeps coming around again. Michael Arrington at TechCrunch has said, came from the world of VCs and investing as a lawyer, and stopped investing in 2009, and then decided recently that he would start investing in companies again that TechCrunch covers. Kara Swisher kind of came out and said, now this is owned by AOL. What's AOL's? What's their rules on ethics? What are their ethical rules about what journalists can own? I mean, there's a long time thing among traditional journalists that, reporters at a place like the Wall Street Journal, can't own stock in any companies, really. And then you have some journalists, when it comes to politics, they won't vote in elections. So, there've been kind of extremes on both sides, and now in the world of new media, you've got a lot of smaller kind of publications out there, small, nimble startups, similar to what you did with paid content, a little similar to what we're doing with Media Shift. How do you deal with conflicts when they come up? You try to disclose, but does the audience really care about all this stuff?
I don't think they do, as long as the quality of your journalism is good. I don't necessarily think it's the audiences care, especially as we're assuming that audiences attention is focused on us when it's 50,000 other things and they're looking at us in a stream of 50,000 other sources. So I think we're giving ourselves way more importance than we need to.
But how do you, in your situation, I think people do care a little bit about, you know, where their information is coming from, what do they trust, the whole thing around credibility. I think that's important to some extent. How do you deal with if when paid content was smaller and you were kind of blogger, publisher, salesperson, when you had to do everything yourself, there has to be times where it's like, do I cover this company? They're an advertiser. That becomes sticky.
For us, we didn't used to cover vendors so much, which were the advertisers on paid content, and we used to cover the sort of consumer companies that vendors were selling into. So there was a somewhat of a line between what we covered and what kind of advertisers we had. Right. I think one of the things that helps, it does help, is in entrepreneurial situations like mine and yours, the fact that a journalist is an entrepreneur gives it a moral center, so to speak. And I think some of those conflicts are avoided or disclosed pretty clearly. So I think being a journalist entrepreneur probably has more credibility than somebody else. I don't want to stretch that logic too much, but that seems to be one of the general trends. What conflicts do you come up with? Since you have foundation grants and stuff, and you're also covering the foundations as well.
Yeah, I think within my within my grant from Knight, there was a line put in there saying, I can cover Knight and write about them in whatever way, necessary, and I'm going to remain editorially independent. And if they do something good, I'm going to say they did something good. And if they screw something up, then I'm going to say that too. So, with them, that's been pretty clear. With other sponsors, we do cover, we have some sponsors that are journalism schools, and we do cover journalism education in some of the schools. And I've definitely heard from some, we should have more coverage. And I've also, we had a sponsorship package that didn't come through, and we had some negative coverage of that sponsor, and it wasn't directly said to me, this is why we're not going to do the sponsorship, but I think that that's possible. There was a connection there, and I just think that, there are some tricky situations where when you do have that question of, what do you cover, what do you not cover, and someone even brought this up about TechCrunch too, which is, there are decisions going on. Not only is it what you cover and what you can see as someone looking into it, but it's what you don't cover and what you don't look at. Like you're saying, you don't cover the vendors and they're your sponsors. Well, what happens if something did come up with the vendors and it was a big enough story that you had to cover it?
Yeah, and there we decided that we were going to restrict our coverage to sort of the money part, which was venture capital or M&A. So, So if they got money, because we covered all venture capital in our industry, we would cover that. And if they got an exit, that's what we cover M&A, and that's what we covered. So, it's not an either or situation. We sort of avoided for most part most of it, but it's not that cut and dry in most of the industries. What Arrington Mike is doing at TechCrunch, I would not have been able to do that. I just would not have been able to justify my existence as a journalist if I were involved in also investing in a lot of those companies. And Silicon Valley is I think this is a very peculiar Silicon Valley problem that is probably amplified way more there than anywhere else. Politics is the only other parallel that I can think of where these conflicts of interest and the lines of overlap are so complex.
Yeah, and then what about Om Malik now? Because Giga Om just got this round of funding. And you know, Ohm himself is a VC, is an actual VC, and is saying, you know, if something comes up, I'm going to disclose it. If I'm going to write about it. But I mean, that's even more so in a way than Arrington, if he's an actual VC, you know, on a VC
Yeah,
firm.
he's a venture partner. There could some be technical issues or whether he's technically a VC or a strategic advisor. But beyond
Okay.
that, I think here's where reputation helps. I mean, Ohm was a very well-known, very well-respected journalist for years and years and years before he started this. And I think that's what I said is that people give respect to journalists somewhat more leeway. In this kind of stuff, and this is exactly what we saw, where Business Insider did a story yesterday, right? That was the link that you and I are referring to, which is they said, well, why is everybody making noise about Mike when Ohm has been doing this for years? And I think the
Right.
reality is because his reputation is a lot better, and also I think his line of disclosures are probably slightly more clear than Arrington.
Right, and Arrington started out as a lawyer and someone who was very much a Silicon Valley insider, whereas Ohm started out as just a journalist who kind of became an insider over time.
Yeah, I think so. And also here's where I think years of experience matters in the industry doing sort of what you do day in, day out. And I think that's why the consumers, and also he's more low key. I mean, if you're out there just trashing everybody, and that's your MO, then of course people are going to come back and bite.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of the Media Twits. I'm Mark Glazer with PBS Media Shift, along with Rafat Ali, founder of Paid Content. And thanks to our special guest, Jen Lee Reeves from the University of Missouri and KOMU. And we want to thank PBS and the Knight Foundation for making this podcast possible. Don't forget to stay in touch with all the news, polls, and events over at PBS Media Shift at pbs.org/mediashift and our sister site, Idea Lab, at pbs.org/idealab. We'll catch you next week.